first speaker will be Les Batty. Les works for HealthPro Group Limited of Peterborough as an ecologist, and will be speaking to us on nature conservation and changing environment and creation care theology to help us in that. Les.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I must add that what I've got to say has got nothing to do with my employer, so just to make that clear. This talk has evolved a little bit since the abstract was written, so although if you read the abstract, although the theme remains the same, I'm dealing with it in a little different. I'm going to start first. First part of my talk, just looking at some aspects of nature conservation philosophy and practice in the UK. I don't know a lot about conservation in other parts of the world in terms of how things are done to compare with the UK, but maybe some aspects of what I've got to say will be similar. Now, nature conservation in the UK results from quite a complex relationship between historical principles, the way that conservation has developed, traditional practices, which I'll look at in a moment, and reactive management, dealing with problems as they arise. Traditional practices, because quite a lot of nature conservation in Britain is based on traditional practices. A lot of woodland management is based on traditional practices of cutting trees down every few years to get a new growth, which was then used for making charcoal for various industries. And by doing this, called coppicing, you get quite a nice show of flowers, and which is very valued, particularly sort of extensive bluebells. And even when there is no longer a market for the wood, the traditional practices are finished, that traditional way of coppicing is often continued simply for nature conservation purposes. The traditional conservation paradigm in the UK tends to be something like this. It tends to assume environmental stability. It emphasises certain charismatic species and cherished landscapes, which are often cultural landscapes like coppiced woods. It tends to promote management for a desired state. We decide what habitat we want, at what stage in development, what species we want, and we manage towards that end. And natural processes and changes are often perceived as threats. And we've got quite a good example here in North Norfolk, where we've got a shingle barrier, which you can just see with the sea on the other side. This ought to be brackish marshes, salt marsh, but through sort of long ages of land claim, we've got grazing marshes and freshwater marshes, and that is perpetuated by nature conservation management to maintain features which are of interest to birdwatchers. The dominant conservation system, previous colleague of mine has said it's product-based. In many ways it is. We produce the features, the species that people desire to see or think we ought to have. We have specific objectives, targets, measurable outcomes, and success is measured by the response of target species. And so we have features, which are species or habitats or whatever that we're interested in for one reason or another. We see a desired state of these species or habitats. Our objective is to reach that state or to maintain it. We develop a management prescription that then works on the influencing factors, and we get the features at the desired state that we want. Sometimes you get the impression that habitats can't manage themselves, they have to be managed. And to me, you get things, sort of ludicrous statements like, woodland wildlife in Britain is declining because woodlands are no longer managed. You know, they can't cope themselves. They've got to be interfered with. The problem with this is the results often don't work. We often have conflicting targets, and a site that I'm very familiar with on a coastal area has wildlife features of importance on the shingle barrier, wildlife features of conservation importance in the back barrier marshes, but the management that would benefit the shingle flora and fauna doesn't benefit these. It's the opposite. If you manage the area for the shingle, it destroys this. If you manage for this, it destroys the shingle features. So we've got these conflicting targets in a conservation system. We often have very contrived wildlife features. This may be one of them. A huge great concrete block with lots of holes in for sand martin, small birds that normally nest in sandy banks of rivers. Normally nesting nowhere near there, but now they're there because of this huge concrete block. Frequently management is unsustainable. This is a case in point. Natural processes, you're battling natural processes all the time. And frequently, anything but nature conservation. You're conserving something, you're creating something, but you could question whether it's nature. What I'm saying may be some sort of extreme viewpoints, but there is something in that. And in many ways, it's not working. This sort of approach to conservation is inadequate to deal with dynamic environments and changes caused by global warming, such as this coast here, which is a very dynamic soft coast, and which is being changed by sea level rise. And the sort of traditional management system is coming a cropper here. It just doesn't work. But we seem to be taken a bit by surprise with change, and yet change is not new. This remarkable statement from Aristotle in the 4th century BC, the same regions do not always remain sea or always land, but all change their condition in the course of time. And possibly that was referring to this area in Greece, Helica, which apparently disappeared into the sea during his lifetime as a result of an earthquake. But we often try and practice nature conservation as though change didn't happen. New, more flexible approaches are emerging or have emerged, such as the ecosystem approach, which is particularly linked with the biodiversity convention. And that does emphasise the fact that change is inevitable, and it does aim at fully functioning ecosystems and sustainability. But it does also recognise in its 12 principles that what we say, sustainability and what we do with the earth is society's choice, and it tries to integrate conservation and economics. So we have this sort of Venn diagram model frequently reproduced to represent the ecosystem approach. We also have the development or projected development of landscape scale ecological networks to try and give nature enough room to move and to change. But what about creation care? What does the creation care approach, the creation care theology, have to say? Can it inform us in terms of these sorts of dilemmas? Is it just a motivation to Christians to care, or can it actually help us to think, well, in what way should we do it? So can it, has it an answer to practical conservation dilemmas? Can it contribute to resolving conservation problems? And in particular, can it help us to adapt to change? And what I'm saying is, it's a bit of a work in progress on sort of trying to work this out in terms of practical conservation issues. And I've sort of looked at the literature, which very much is was reflected in the talks we had this morning, to see, well, what are the key themes, to sort of encapsulate the key themes in creation care. And I came up with this little model. The key themes as I saw are creation, value and integrity as the basic theme, human needs and responsibility as the second, and reconciliation as the third. If we unpack these themes, what I mean by creation's value and integrity and what I draw out from the literature is, as we were hearing this morning, the earth was created by God, displays his glory and belongs to him. So that's the very basic. We were told very emphatically that everything was created good, in its own right, in its place, in creation, and for God's purpose. And the earth is not just a resource, and creatures are not just commodities. Just sort of dwelling a little bit on this word integrity, one of the first writers on the subject of Christians and the environment, Francis Schaeffer, wrote that God treats his creation with integrity, each thing in its own order, each thing the way he made it. Should we not treat our fellow creatures with similar integrity? And the Worldwide Anglican Communion has come up with five marks of mission, the fifth being to strive to safeguard the integrity of creation and to sustain and renew the life of the earth. Two sort of meanings of the word integrity used in those two statements. Uprightness, honesty, probably emphasised here. The wholeness, the entireness, the soundness, the unimpaired state here. Second theme, human needs and responsibilities. We've seen that humans have been given the provision of cultivating the earth for their needs and the responsibility to keep and protect God's creation. Also has been mentioned the need to allow the earth its Sabbath rests. And I think by Sabbath rests, it's not working the earth. We could translate that another way and say, in the absence of any sort of intervention. And linked to the first, the earth is God's, we hold the earth in trust. And thirdly, the other big theme in the literature is reconciliation. A Church of England publication some years ago in 1972 made this, I'm not quite sure to describe it, but a remarkable statement. Despoiling the earth is a blasphemy, not just an error of judgment. It's not just, oh dear, we've made a mistake. It's what we're doing is a blasphemy. As a result of the fall, there is division between humanity, nature and God. We need to be reconciled to God and his creation. And therefore, a big tool in conservation is education. But education alone is not enough. So the work of reconciliation really is part of a Christian approach to nature conservation. So that's the theological framework. How do we turn this into a practical framework for application on the ground. Well, I'm just beginning to do this. But I've come up with these six principles based on those three themes. We acknowledge that we hold the earth in trust from God. We respect the value and integrity of creation, which in effect is ecosystems and species. We must meet human needs. We must keep and protect nature. We must allow the earth its Sabbath rests. And we work for reconciliation between humanity and God's creation. Then we've got to work this on the ground. Maybe I'll skip over that, because basically what I've done is linked these different principles to different areas of an ecosystem. But we might then be able to bring those principles together and try and produce a practical framework compared with the original framework that I showed of a nature conservation system. So our features are ecosystems and species. Our objective, in my mind, is the integrity of creation, but in practice, the integrity of ecosystems. Our job, then, is to keep and protect nature. That is going to involve reconciliation. It's going to involve Sabbath rests for the earth. In so doing, we meet human needs, and otherwise we keep the ecosystems and species in their integrity. Going back to the title of my talk is, well, okay, but how does this help us to adapt to change? And my answer is by focusing on ecosystem integrity rather than a desired state of particularly valued target species or ecosystems. Well, what does ecosystem integrity mean in practice? Now, often what it means, and I've met it in my work, it means maintaining all the valued components of a system all together in a particular state by means of a program of manipulation and regulation. But a better view is represented, I think, by this diagram. This is the integrity of a coastal ecosystem that started life as a barrier-built estuary, but as a result of fall in sea level combined with coastal engineering, moved in this direction towards a barrier with freshwater habitats. With sea level rise and coastal dynamics turning the other way, then the natural process is back towards a barrier-built estuary. Now, our human instinct is to try and keep it there, because that's where we drove it in the first place, and that it's got interesting species and interesting habitats, and maybe we're used to that system, and we see the sea as a threat. But in actual fact, that whole complex dynamic system is the integrity of that system. Carl DeWitt used this morning the term dynamic integrity. And I think that's a good example of dynamic integrity. So that is the ecosystem. It changes, it comes and goes, depending on what the coastal dynamics are doing, what the sea level's doing. And so it encompasses change. So the nature and integrity of creation, by which we mean the wholeness, the entireness, the unimpaired state of ecosystems, includes change and the ability and space to change, to adapt. I'm just about finished. So creation care theology can help us to adapt our conservation practice to a changing environment by, I suggest, presenting a paradigm which emphasises and values the wholeness, the integrity of creation and all its species, accepts change in ecosystems as a feature of their integrity, and consequently recognises the need to safeguard the integrity of creation by allowing it sufficient space to adapt. The implications of this and its relation to other approaches like the ecosystem approach, that's another story, and I've got to think of that.
Thank you.
That was an excellent presentation, and it brings us to look at maintaining a dynamic integrity in restoration rather than simply, as it has been done in the older days, looking at a target ecosystem that you're attempting to achieve. So it's quite a good advance, I think, in our understanding. We'll open questions then to Les Batty. Yes, sir.
I'd like to propose, you keep using the term integrity of creation. I'd like to propose to use the term beauty of creation, because I think beauty implies integrity, which I think we include, but it also includes a theological aspect as to beauty's giver. So why not use beauty of creation rather than integrity?
Yeah, interesting concept. Thank you. Yeah, I'll think about that.
Other questions? Beauty, of course, in mathematics, beauty is often identified with integrity. And so I suppose we could see beauty as a part of integrity.
Yeah.
There was another question, yes.
Who would you say was to decide which of these ecosystems that we have or we've created is the one to be kept? You know, you talked about the dynamic integrity and things change, but quite a lot we've changed things so dramatically over such a long period of time, there is nowhere for it to go back to how it was.
No, I don't think it necessarily can go back to where it was, but it may be trying to go somewhere, and certainly some of these systems I know are trying to go somewhere, and we are trying to prevent them. Now, they may not go back to what they once were, but this is something we need to look at, and there may be some difficult decisions in another way to do, but I think what we are doing with some systems, as I know, is trying to, we are, in the name of nature conservation, we are trying to prevent systems from being what they ought to be, from what the natural processes, both internal and external, are driving them to be. So there is this tension in them.
Just picking up what you just said about preventing systems from evolving to a state where they would naturally be, but where they are going is somewhere that we've pushed them very artificially. So, I mean, most of the change that we're talking about, that we're worrying about in conservation, is due to climate change, anthropogenic climate change, which is pushing systems such as sea levels and mandatory treatment, to states that are really not consistent with the sort of integrity of creation that you're talking about.
But aren't we compounding that? Because we've changed them to something that was nothing like what they ought to be, and so we've got maybe natural processes that are trying to get them back to something like they ought to be. But we're preventing that as well.
I'm just thinking they won't go back.
They won't go back, no.
Because of sea level rise and climate change, and things, it's not. You know, if we just left everything alone, it wouldn't revert to what it was in 1900.
No, but it would adjust to the current and future situation.
It seems to me that what is required is some discernment as to whether the changes that that nature's processes of nature are pushing the environment to are healthy changes, and whether they should be allowed or whether they would be detrimental to human needs, perhaps, or and whether you need to maintain or make a change in a different direction, but not just with the sea level changes, but with any maintenance that is preventing natural processes from occurring.
When it comes to human needs, that is another thing. Mm-hmm. But by trying to prevent systems from changing to something that maybe wasn't what they were in the past, but it's somewhere in the future that we don't know. If we try and prevent that, in some instance, we're actually wiping out the species that inhabit there, mm-hmm. because they're between a rock and a hard place.
And that's where you need the discernment to make that decision.
Yeah.
Right, and to what extent do you think we should, given that climate change is going to change the climate very fast, much faster than ever before, and so it's very difficult for species to migrate or adapt. I mean, to what extent do you think you should literally transplant an ecosystem? Like, for example, if the whole Mediterranean is going to become desert, should you try and move like the Mediterranean ecosystem into south of England? And you know, if the choice is between losing the whole lot in the Mediterranean, if the south of England is going to become a Mediterranean climate, should you hold, like, for example, people have planted successfully olive groves in Cornwall, so you could say, well, bring in the rest of the olive grove ecosystem, bring in the ants and the wasps or whatever. That, do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I mean, I can, because, I mean, I've not developed my thinking sort of that far in terms of detail, but I think if we've so altered the system so that these systems can no longer migrate naturally, or one thing we can do is try and as some people are advocating and actually practicing, is build sort of big corridors through which ecosystems can move. If there's still barriers in the way, then maybe we should consider, because we've caused the trouble in the first place, of actually helping them to move.
Well, some of the literature I've been reading suggests that, you know, even if you have a wide corridor, the trees can't grow fast enough.
They can't move fast enough, that's right.
So we might, that's right.
Yes, I mean, certainly there is a lot general in the sort of general ecological work and ecological literature on this sort of thing. I still find, there's a sort of gradation between a free-for-all type of approach and an approach which talks in a bigger scale, but still actually when you examine it, it's back to the micromanagement of species and habitats, but on a bigger scale.
We thank you, Les, for a very fine presentation.
There's a few copies of my talk here if anybody wants to take one. Thank you.
Thank you.